Our communities want empathetic police officers. They're asking for this. They're asking to be heard and to be understood. And yet the police service still insists that we don't want people that are emotional, that we don't want people that are emotionally sensitive. How do we deal with them?
Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
Today's guest, S.J. Lenny, is a chartered psychologist and lecturer in the Police Organisation and Practice Department of the Open University. SJ specialises in social psychology, emotions in the workplace, and the mental health and well-being of police officers. Prior to returning to academia, SJ served for 18 years as a police officer to the rank of detective inspector. She is an associate to the College of Policing as a subject matter expert in mental health and organisational culture, and her research focus is on supporting police officers' emotional well-being through the exploration of officers' lived experience and the impact of organisational culture on individual mental health. SJ looks at the role of stigma, emotional suppression and dissociation in the increasing cases of post-traumatic stress disorder within British police officers. Really delighted to have you along today, SJ, for a conversation. Looking forward to hearing what you've got to say.
Well, thank you very much for asking me along. It's great to be able to talk about this subject.
And I suspect there'll be a lot of overlap with staff that also work in prisons in terms of what you have to say.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, definitely. I think in all social services area and emergency services, I think, you know, there's a lot of familiar themes. I'll be very familiar to people.
Hi, SJ. It's a great pleasure to meet you today. I think it's fair to say you've had a very full and varied career. Can you tell us something about the pathway that you've taken through, well, it's through many layers of the police service towards becoming an academic?
Hi, David. You call it a pathway and you make it sound planned, and that it certainly wasn't. When I was 19, I joined the army as a musician, and that's where my career began in kind of, I guess, those sort of public service orientated associations. But my parents were police officers, and I had a military background in the family as well, and that's what led me to a uniform service. It's very familiar to me, but I was also very much into music and classical music. But very quickly I got bored and moved on, went back to university, studied then, and then decided that I enjoyed the law, but I wanted to do something that was very practical. I didn't consider myself an academic in any sense or in any way. I failed my 11 plus, if people know what that is. Certainly academia wasn't anything that I liked, but something that I didn't think I could do. So I joined the police and was quite surprised that I did quite well. People called me talented, and I thought that was something that you referred to as music, all those sorts of performing arts talents. But I really loved it. It felt to me like this is what I was destined to do. I enjoyed it. I loved it. I felt comfortable doing it. It meant so much to me. And it meant so much to me to be a police officer and to be part of that police service family. I moved quickly through the ranks, which was not an intention or something I anticipated. I only joined ever to want to be drive fast cars, I have to be honest, and potentially shoot guns and stuff like that. I was definitely into that operational side of things. But I got promoted very quickly to sergeant within 3 years, and then on to inspector. And at this time, I was down in Hampshire Constabulary after I'd left the police, the army. And I decided to come back home. I'm from Liverpool, so I joined Greater Manchester Police, and I was looking for, you know, more challenges, bright lights, big city, all of that. I got lucky. I joined Greater Manchester Police, and I started working there. I went into counterterrorism, which was absolutely fantastic. I absolutely loved it. But still, I was a DS then, and people were saying, well, why don't you go for promotion? which there wasn't any at the time. So I went for HPDS as a route in. And I got onto the High Potential Development Scheme, which was, again, was a surprise, but it gave me the opportunity to go into different worlds. When I got onto that, I was asked where I'd like to be posted. And I thought, well, I want to prove myself operationally because there's this stigma around HPDS and accelerated promotion. So I said, well, I'd really like to be a DI and I would like to go into a frontline operational position, and I'd like to do it in central Manchester, basically. So, excuse my dog there. I got posted to Withenshaw. And if you don't know Withenshaw, it's a council estate just on the edge of South Manchester. There's a lot of violence, a lot of gangs, and a lot of really intense crime, which is exactly what I wanted and it's what I asked for. But it took its toll on me, and I really had not anticipated at any point that how much it would take its toll on me. And I started recognising in myself that something wasn't right, but I didn't know what, and I couldn't articulate what, and I couldn't talk about it either. I looked around me and I saw that everybody else was coping, and that I needed to cope too, and that I needed to present this image on one sense, because I was that HPDS girl and I needed to prove myself and I wasn't going to be the weak one, but also I had people that I was looking after. And I needed to be strong for them because I could see that they were under so much pressure as well. So I kept trying to work out what was wrong with me, but basically I wasn't sleeping at night. And I mean, I wasn't sleeping at night in terms of I was wired. It wasn't like I was worried about the fact it was insomnia and I was tossing and turning. It's just nights went and I didn't sleep and I was back up early in the morning. I'd go for a run and I'd get back straight into work. I was working 16 plus hours every day. I was afraid to come home because I couldn't leave work, and I felt more comfortable at work because I was doing something about what I was worried about. What I realise now is that my mind was fragmenting. I used to come home and my husband would be, "You've got a head full of magic." I wasn't present. And I was just rerunning all my old cases through my head, checking in detail, in massive detail. I'm very creative in the sense that my imagination's very good. And I was thinking through all my cases, all the evidence, all the statements, all everything that I needed to do. But I was worrying about the outcomes. If I'd missed something, I would have myself up in the dock in an inquiry where I'd failed in some sort of way. I was torturing myself, but I was trying to cover everything. Anyway, a very long story, not quite so short. I realised that I had a choice between my mental health and my career, because I couldn't ask for help. If I asked for help, that would mean that that was it. So I asked to be taken out of my operational role and put onto a project to give me time to think about what to do. And it was at that point that I started speaking to people about my experiences, because then I was like, I'd admitted that, you know, I was struggling, that my mental health wasn't good, for whatever that meant to me. And I started talking to people and they started reflecting back to me, to my experiences. And I realized that pretty much everybody was struggling in the same way. It's just we weren't talking about it. And we were all putting on this facade that we were coping. And that kind of like made me angry, really. When I thought it was my issue on my own, I was like, okay, I'm going to have to deal with this. Fine. I'm going to have to somehow reconcile myself that I'm weak and that I can't do my job. And it broke my heart. I mean, I can say it now, but if you'd asked me like a month, 6 months, a year or so after, it'd still make me cry because I felt so devastated that I lost my job or gave up my job. But when I realised I wasn't alone, I wanted to do something about it. And that's what took me back to academia. And I started looking at what was happening in wellbeing in the police. And I chose to go back to Manchester Met, and I did a master's in human resource management, which wasn't really the direction I wanted to go in. I wanted to look at psychology because I wanted to look at mental health and well-being in the police, but it gave me, I didn't have a background in that. So it gave me the opportunity to explore from an organisational perspective, organisational psychology. And that's where I began my exploration into mental health and well-being and emotions in the workplace and how they affect the individual. And that led me onto my PhD my current role.
Thank you very much. You've written a very powerful blog about the kind of span of years that you've just referred to, and in it you use, I can't quite remember the exact phrase, but you describe the police as being a bit like the armed forces, except that you're having to be on the alert 24 hours a day. So you're always having to be on the alert, unlike the army, who get times when they're resting. I thought that was a very powerful description of the state of mind which many police staff must be in.
Yeah, I think that's really key as well in my own research. And it's recognised a certain amount within the army, the fact that they understand that they can take people in and out of theatre, operational theatre, whereas the police are always within that environment. And it's not just their own conscience and the fact, the desire that they're police officers and their identity. It's actually an expectation of the organisation that if you see something happen, the onus is upon you as an officer, even if you're off duty, that you have to act. And if you don't, the consequences can be quite punitive. So there is this mindset that you are always a police officer, and technically speaking, you are always on duty. And with that comes all the pressures of emotional suppression that I will go on to talk about. But it also feeds into family and friends' expectations of how you behave, not just emotionally, but actually to act. If they see something, they expect you to step in. And that's an awful lot of pressure. That means that you never step away from being a police officer. And when we look at kind of like the rules around emotional expression, it means that they never leave you, which is a big part of the issue with police officers coping and processing their events in their lives.
Yeah, I think that's so true. I think all of us invest police officers with great power and authority, and from that we expect them to take charge, in situations where we may be extremely afraid ourselves.
Yeah, I think it's right, though. That is the police officer's job. It is right that, and that's what you join for, and you understand, and the public has that right to that expectation, is that they are there to, as the old saying goes, you know, run into danger, to protect people, to put their lives, not necessarily on the line, because that shouldn't always be the way, but to put themselves before others. But that has become to translate into police officers are less than human, that yes, they make these sacrifices, they put themselves forward, doesn't mean that they aren't experiencing those emotions. They just mean that those moments that they are actively not acting on them. But after that incident, they're still a human being, and I think we've lost sight of that.
Yeah, thanks very much. Okay, so you're back at university. Was this the second time you've been back at university, or the third time?
No, this is the second time I've been back at university. So after I left the army, I have this sporadic career path. It's not a pathway at all. I after the army, I left and returned back to university. I studied randomly shipping. I would have studied anything. I just love to study things. I'm very happy to study anything. I'm just nosy, I guess, inquisitive. And that's where I really got into law. Believe it or not, maritime law. I was really excited about that and really interested in the work of the law. But as I said, I wanted a practical career, which is why I chose the police. So yeah, my master's was my second term at university.
Okay, thank you. So what then made you decide to study emotional labour and the police? And what do you mean by that term, emotional labour?
Serendipity, really. Initially, it was actually one of my colleagues in the police that heard that I was studying and I was looking at mental health and wellbeing, and said, have you read, one of my HPDS colleagues, have you heard about emotional labour, and passed me a paper. It was as simple as that. But I had been looking at lots of theories to try and articulate and frame what I was seeing in the police service, and emotional labour really spoke to me, as that's what I saw and believed was happening. Now, that is a very subjective response, because it's my perspective of what's happening in the police service, and I'm very open about that my research is inevitably biased and tainted by my experience and my perception of what the police service is, but emotional labour is the theory that I felt best suited what I was trying to articulate. So when I talk about emotional labour, to give it proper credence, was first conceptualised by Arlie Hochschild in 1983. She was actually studying hostesses, and they're a really good way of describing what emotional labour is. So emotional labour is the work that you do on behalf of the organisation, required by the organisation to present the correct emotions that the organisation requires as part of your job in exchange for a wage. It's emotion work, and we do this every part of our lives, in every relationship with our lives. You will recognise the work that you do outside of the organisational setting, and it's about suppressing emotions that you may be feeling towards something and expressing something different. So my best example that I can give is we're very polite, very kind people more often than not, and when somebody gives you a present, perhaps somebody that you like and don't want to offend, and perhaps it's not a present that you genuinely like, you don't tell them, and you suppress that disappointment and you express something visually, so you display an emotion. And often, more often than not, we try and conjure up that feeling within ourselves so that we try and make this person believe that we're grateful for the present, that we like the present. And that is emotion work. It's hiding and displaying something contrary to what our authentic emotions are. We take that into the organisational setting. A lot of the issue with emotional labour is a lot of the emotions that we experience at work, or the emotions that we're experiencing whilst we're at work, may be personal to us, and actually not being able to articulate them actually can be quite damaging and can be quite challenging and can be quite exhausting. So a lot of the main outcomes of emotional labour at work are burnout, emotional exhaustion. And this is what happened with air hostesses, who were expected to be happy all the time.
Hmm. Yes, good example that. So, has there been much research on emotional literacy and emotional labour, particularly as related to the police service?
There's not a great deal of research. Obviously, I looked into this at the beginning of my PhD. It's quite limited. And it's inconsistent. So the majority of research into emotional labour in the police takes quite a positivist approach. It's very reductionist, and it's set in different settings, and it's looked at from different ways. You may have people looking at suppression in relation to emotional exhaustion, or in another setting, look at display, emotional display rules, and whether that links to depersonalisation. So a lot of it's inconsistent and doesn't create a really good literature base and a good understanding, which is why I really wanted to get into the qualitative approach, to really get that context of understand what was happening to police officers, and why it was happening, and what they believed was expected of them, and what was the outcome for them.
Thanks very much. Just thinking about the police, how do you think the organisational culture is communicated to employees?
Typically with emotional labour, it's often implied rather than being very explicit. It's not often you find the rules written down. But in the police there are some. So if you have the code of ethics, police officers aren't allowed to show aggression, ironically, because that is the one emotion that does get displayed. So there is some governance about how police officers behave, but it is mainly done by observation, so observing your peers. Police officers, when they join, like all of us, we want to be accepted. We want to show that we're good at our job. We take cues from the people around us, particularly the people that we respect or who are senior to us. So the way that others conduct themselves around us. But also, there's quite a punitive response to emotional display within the police service, and reference to mental health or mental health struggles. So if a look at the example of firearms. Firearms officers, sorry, I should say. So they are charged with a great responsibility, carrying a firearm. And because of this, they need to have good mental health. They need to be good decision makers, need to be quite stable. Absolutely correct. But they are told that should they be feeling any sense that they may be struggling with their mental health, whether it be within the job or without, for whatever circumstances, that they need to report that to their supervisors so that, you know, the appropriate steps can be taken. But those appropriate steps are typically quite punitive. They'll have their ticket taken off them. They'll be removed from their team. So they become isolated. There's a sense of shaming that occurs in doing this, that they can't do their job, that they're less than, that they are weak, which is often implied. And support is lacking for those people. There isn't a great deal of external, or sorry, organisational, but, you know, added on help to support people that do say they're struggling with their mental health. And similar punitive steps are taken within all the other organisations. So I have examples from all over the place, but a response officer who says, I'm really struggling with my mental health, the first thing that the organisation does is remove the risk to the organisation and potentially the public, and removes the officer from their position, which is shaming. It's implying that they can't cope, that they can't do the job, that they're of no use to the organisation anymore. It isolates the officer from the team, who are the very people that could actually support that officer and help them with their coping and their processing. And it makes them feel that they can't return. And officers see that this is the response when people do ask for help or they do struggle. And because they see that, they know that they too can't ask for help and they won't speak out and they won't speak to. And with that also comes an issue of trust. Police officers are typically not trusting people because that's part of their role, is to be suspicious and to not trust people, and becomes more ingrained in them the more that they are within the organisation. But there isn't trust within their colleagues, because they know that the punitive response to talking openly about their emotional experiences, they are concerned about who is listening, quite literally. Can they trust the person in front of them? And when they've experienced the changes as we have at the moment to policing and the police service, yes, where teams are quite disparate, people don't often work together. We have an issue with lone working in the police and remote working. I don't mean working at home. I mean, people are put single crewed in police cars or on the beat, wherever it be. They're not building up relationships where they know who they can trust and who they can talk to. And whilst the consequences are so dire for their career to speak out, and if they don't know who they can trust, then it's not likely that if they are struggling, that they're going to speak to anyone, which for me is really concerning, because that means that we have a lot of potentially very ill police officers operational on the front line.
It seems as though the pressure is to be something that's totally unattainable. I mean, I liked the reference to RoboCop within one of your papers, because actually we're talking about people trying not to be human beings. Emotion is what gives us our vitality, isn't it? It's part of the human existence. And yet you seem to be describing a culture that makes it not possible to be a fully rounded human being and have the full array of emotions. And I also wondered whether that's even necessarily desirable for the role in terms of emotional burden, because when I think about the similarities with the prison service, where I think there's some similarities in terms of that pressure to not acknowledge fear, for instance, and yet I work within a service where we've spent a lot of time encouraging staff to openly talk about fear, because actually if you can talk about the fact a situation's frightening, but you're still going to manage this situation anyway, that actually allows you to also acknowledge the courage within that situation. If you don't acknowledge fear, you can't acknowledge courage, because you're not being courageous if you're not frightened.
I think that's a really excellent point. I may steal it from you. yeah, you're absolutely right. There is a culture, and it's not just within the organisation, or certainly it's not perceived just to be within the organisation. It's actually social, I believe. And that's where the term RoboCop came from, is actually from some of my participants who said it's the public that expects them to be like robots. But you're right, it's within the organisation. And I believe it is, and it is detrimental to the organisation to have people that aren't in touch with their emotions. if you have people that aren't able to identify their emotional response, fear, when they're going into a situation, they're going to put themselves in danger and they're going to put other people into danger. So it's necessary. It's a natural. Our emotions are alarm bells. They're indicators. They're information that we can use to navigate our lives. And I'm still at pains for the police to convince the police services the need to have emotionally aware people, to have emotionally sentient beings. There is still within the organisation a belief that emotions are a weakness. And really, if you remove the emotions from a person, they're a psychopath. They don't have an emotional relationship with people. Our communities want empathetic police officers. They're asking for this. They're asking to be heard and to be understood. And yet the police service still insists that we don't want people that are emotional, that we don't want people that are emotionally sensitive. How do we deal with them? And I think there's, from the organisation, there's almost a cost implication to giving people the space to be emotional and to understand their emotions and to support them and allow them to process. It's almost like they say, we don't have time for this. And that's what police officers are hearing. That's the message that they're taking, is that the police service doesn't have time for emotional people or people with emotions. But the truth is, that's the human brain.
And perhaps I'd just like to ask you something, SJ, and we can cut it out if you're not happy answering the question. But I suppose, you know, the cost of not being at work as a fully rounded emotional human being plays a role in terms of some of the criticism that's levied at the police when there are, you know, incidents of police brutality or perceived police brutality. That actually, if somebody's not freely permitted to be an emotional human being at work, then as you say, what happens is people end up in a colder, harsher place, which perhaps facilitates those kind of actions.
Absolutely. I firmly believe that nobody joins the police to be a cruel bully. And if they did, I would like to think that our recruiting process would weed them out and we wouldn't have them in within the ranks. We make people like this within the organisation. We turn them into cold people. They become depersonalised from the people that they're working with because they lose touch with their own emotions. So part of emotional labour and part of my research has shown that police officers are dissociating from their emotions, which means they don't feel things, they're pushing them away, and they become not to have emotions in all of their life. And because of this, they stop being able to identify with other people. So we know that to be compassionate, you need to be self-compassionate. So until you can identify your own emotions, you're not going to be emotionally aware and emotionally intelligent enough to understand other people. So you can see how this translates into police brutality, because people stop seeing people as human beings anymore. The language within the organisation really adds to this. It's a very dissociative, you know, language. We will talk about the victim. We will talk about the witness, next door neighbour, mum of. We just see people as tasks or problems. And yet I firmly believe that the majority of the misdemeanors, the majority of complaints that are made against the police are down to the culture and the fact that police officers themselves do not feel that they're able to be a truly rounded, emotional, empathetic human being. And I think that goes further in terms of what police officers want. I found within my research that they know that they're not functioning. They know they're not feeling things that they should. But worse still is they feel prohibited from delivering the service they want to the public. People are citing to me how when they are single crewed and attend an incident, they will give a different service, a more empathetic, relational service to the people they see in front of them than if their colleagues there, because they will feel that they will be judged and that they may get spoken about if they are more communicative, if they're more emotional, if they're more open with the people, with the members of the public they're dealing with. I think it's dreadful, because this is what the public wants. This is what makes you good at your job. This is what will prevent an escalation in violence, if you can talk to people. It's what will make people feel more safe to trust the police. It will allow communities to open up to the police if they see them as human beings. Yet we expect them to be less than human, and that is an organisational requirement.
So how is this culture going to be changed then? Because I was slightly puzzled because you were describing the accelerated promotion and training scheme. I can't remember the full list.
HPDS. High Potential Development Scheme.
And so people like yourself get accepted for that. I presume a small number of a larger total get accepted, and then you get a very good training and go through a further period of education at the university. So you're training there, or the police are training there, a group of leaders who should be cultural icons, who should be able to spread the culture throughout the force. Is that, does that happen at all, or is it just too big a task?
If you're talking in terms of accelerated promotion and the difference, the selection process for key leaders, I guess, because the landscape's changed now since I was there. I didn't perceive, and I didn't see, and I don't see that this cultural, emotional, empathetic, compassionate way of leading is taught. Small caveat on that, that I will be delivering my research to the senior command course this October. And I have delivered a few pieces on emotional intelligence and authentic leadership. And I think, as far as I know, and I'm not saying this because I'm bigging myself up, genuinely, I don't think there's anything else that really goes towards that in terms of culture. How are we going to change the culture as it is? Well, we know culture is difficult to change. It's a huge service if you take it in its entirety. It has a couple of hundred years of history steeped in machismo and a crime-fighting context, which we don't have anymore, but is still the culture. I think it's difficult. But we do have an opportunity. We have 20,000 new recruits that are coming into the ranks, and they're going through an education system. They're being professionalised through a degree. And that is a massive opportunity. And also, looking at the generation that we will be recruiting from, we call them millennials. They've been called some dreadful names. They are more emotionally intelligent than any other generation that I think I've come across. And they are an opportunity. And I just hope that they don't get absorbed in a way that some have, when they've been on their own, into the way of being that is the police service as it stands.
Thank you. So just coming back to your research again, could you sum, and you've begun this already, could you sum up the findings of your research?
Yeah, definitely. So I looked at emotional labour and I looked at the psychological impact on police officers. Emotional labour is, I looked at the outcomes in terms of burnout, but I also looked at, one of the outcomes was dissociative behaviour. Dissociation is now recognised in the DSM-5 as a key element of PTSD. Post, pre, and during a traumatic incident. And I'm finding that police officers are being expected and are acting out dissociative behaviour. So they are compartmentalising, suppressing, avoiding their emotional responses to the point where some are now saying they don't have a normal emotional response. They recognise a lack of response. My findings also show, as I indicated earlier, that this spans the whole of their lives. So it's not just when they're in the organisation, it's not just when they're out on the streets, not just out when they're dealing with the members of the public. It's when they go home, it's when they're speaking with their families, it's when they're out with their friends. It's all of their lives they're expected to suppress. And in two ways they become dissociative. In one way they're dissociative from their own emotions and they're not experiencing them. A death in the family, police officers are realising that they can't mourn because they can't feel. Sadly, they're also recognising that they don't see joy when they see their children. Heartbreaking things. But they're also dissociative from their surroundings as well, in terms of they will be at home with their family, but in their mind, they're dealing with the experiences of the day or the week or the years that they still haven't processed. So they're not fully in their moment. They're not fully integrated into where they are at that point. So they are highly dissociative. There's high levels of shame within the organization, and they feel that. They put the pressures upon themselves. So society, the organization, the media, presents police officers and presents the public with an ideal of a police officer. And police officers try and live up to this because they are there to serve the public. They join the police to serve the public, and they believe wholly that that is what they want to do. And the people who are the illest and the ones who are struggling the most, are the ones that go that extra mile to be that person, which means not going home, which means when they do go home, they're probably volunteering, which means that they will stay home and take on extra work, which means that they will follow victims more than others. They will take on other people's work, and they can't be shown to be feeling anything because they will always put other people first. And they won't ask for help because they have to be this image of a police officer. And what it's leading to is, the stats show it, 1 in 5 police officers and police staff have PTSD, active PTSD. It's likely to be an awful lot higher. There's significant amounts of shame in the service. There's other research that showed that's high levels of humiliation. So Jess Miller is an excellent researcher who's a neuroscientist, and has identified the link between humiliation and shame and suppression of emotions in police officers, and a reduction in the working of the hippocampus. So yeah, my findings are concerning. As people go up the ranks, that this is becomes more prevalent for them to become dissociative, and there's more research to be done there. Is this a case of it's the successful coping? So therefore they're getting on. It's a technique that works for them. And we have people at the top and senior ranks that are very heavily dissociative. Or is it their way of coping? Or is it just, as we say, is it just for role modelling? We're in a hierarchical organisation. We promote in our own like. So there is very little chance for people who are different within the organisation. This goes a lot for diversity as well, to get on within the organisation. And it has a significant impact. I think we have a lot of very, very, very poorly people in the police service who are just working.
It's probably also worth saying, although we're using the kind of like technical diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, we're actually describing something that's a very normal reaction to having to cope with that level of emotionally charged situations, aren't we?
Absolutely. And thank you for raising that, because that is one of the key issues of the police service, is that they don't normalise trauma reaction. So it is normal to have a response to trauma. And that should be allowed to happen in a safe environment. The best way for me, we see a lot of wellbeing interventions going on in the police, and I don't believe that they're effective for many, many different reasons. But the answer is quite simple. It's to create a safe social environment where people who experience similar or the same events can get together and discuss this and have time to process what it is that they deal with. To be traumatized from trauma is normal. To have really strong reactions and to feel overwhelmed is normal. And it's extraordinary what police, prison staff, paramedics, fire service deal with. And they put those emotions aside and still do their job. But they need time to process those emotions and those reactions. Thank you. Yeah, it's absolutely normal.
Your papers are very powerful, SJ. I think, you know, involving qualitative, you know, quotes from participants, I think it's actually a really powerful way of providing research feedback, actually. But in one of them, you refer to a quote by Grande et al. About the dark side of emotional labour, which has been claimed to violate basic human rights. What was meant by this?
It's a great quote, isn't it? Hence, I put it into my research. So, on one side, you see, look at the Human Rights Act. You have a right to express yourself. Simple as that. That's a basic human right. But I think it goes deeper than that. We have a right to, we experience life, and as long as we're not hurting anybody else, we have a right to experience and live and be fulfilled. When you're performing emotional labour, you're not a whole human being. Your own experiences are devalued by the organisation. They're not respected, and therefore you're not respected, and you are devalued. And it's as I said before, it's almost punitive to judge other people's emotional reactions and to respond to them accordingly and say, you don't fit in with your work, you don't fit in here. It is normal to experience emotions and to express them and to engage with other people. We're social creatures, and to understand each other via these emotional experiences and to have the right to tell our own story. So I think when he says that, I think it's quite powerful too, isn't it, to say that statement. But it's right. These are fundamental elements of being a human being and being a social creature. And who has the right to judge them or to deny them in exchange for a wage?
Do you think the organisation should bear some cost for, some responsibility for the cost of that to the human being?
I think they should go further than that. They need to take responsibility to prevent it. As much as having an emotional response is natural response to trauma, being ill as a response to that is not inevitable. And I'd suggest that PTSD is a cause of the environment that you're in at the time of that trauma. So for police officers, the fact that they're in those organisational circumstances and have this culture around them, it's that that causes them to be ill, not the trauma that they're experiencing. The fact that they will see some very traumatic things, a car crash, child protection incidents, terrorism, anything that may be for them traumatic, because we're all individual. It's not that they've seen something traumatic, it's the fact that they can't deal with it, that they're shamed for having emotions, that they're prevented from processing them. That makes illness inevitable, and that is the organisation, that's not the individual. The organisation far too much puts the onus on the individual to be strong, to be resilient, to do something about their illness, when actually, in my eyes, it's the organisations that are causing it. So I think they should bear responsibility for the outcomes to police officers. I think that they also need to look at the business case around actually preventing people from becoming ill. We've talked about the consequences of having ill operational officers that are functioning and the outcomes that may have in terms of anger, in terms of brutality, in terms of incivility. But we also need to look at the cost of sickness, and mental health sickness is prevalent within the organisation. And I've spoken a lot to senior leaders and spoken out greatly about the need to do more about police officer mental health and the need to change the culture and be more compassionate to our police officers. But if they can't see that ethical and moral need to do better by their employees, then surely they can see the business case. If we take time, and I know time is money, we take time to create those environments and to provide police officers the time to process their emotions, we will have less sickness, we will have more police officers.
So it's part of the problem that those very decisions are being made by people who, because they're at the top of the chain, are likely to already be in that state of dissociation themselves.
Absolutely. My firm belief that it's very difficult for people that are dissociative and probably quite ill themselves, whether they know it or not, and probably a lot of them know it, that they are struggling with their own stuff that's going on. And they too are not, that, you know, those senior officers are in an organisation that expects just the same of them as it does of people on the front line, and they are under the same pressures, even up to chief constable. We have the PCC, they're under a lot of scrutiny from the media, from the public, to behave in a certain way, and they've had a career of dissociating, so they're not likely to understand how to be empathetic. Therefore, the decisions they make are going to be tainted by their own mental health, their own lack of emotional response.
You come from two parents who are police officers, I believe, SJ, I think you said.
Yeah.
And I suppose I was struck by how you were interested in all the stuff that, as you were describing the stuff that you were interested in, that you wanted to get involved in the police, was all the stuff I was thinking, shit, I would find that really scary. And so I wondered, you know, were you prepared for the emotional impact of what you were going into, the fact that you were going into something that was going to be potentially very dangerous at times. And how did you override that when you made those choices?
I know I wasn't prepared. The outcome stands to that I wasn't prepared. So both my parents are police officers, correct. My dad became a very senior police officer. I came from a military background, so both families come from Army and Navy. My dad was a Navy pilot before he became police officer, so very military background. We don't do emotions. The job was very normalised for me. It was, I grew up with it. That's what my dad did. My mum had done it previously. I knew the circumstances of what the job was. I understood it. But my parents were both brought up in a culture of you don't express emotions. So I was brought up in a culture of you don't express your emotions. In fact, emotions were a weakness. I never really understood emotions. I never had a handle on it. My parents don't and still don't talk about emotions. I thought I was emotionally strong because I didn't experience emotions. And that was before the police. I thought, I'm not emotional. That was I'm not an emotional person. That was like a good thing for me. Yay, well done me. Because I just didn't have any understanding. I just had absolutely no understanding of emotions, emotion response. I didn't know what I was experiencing myself. I grew up, now I know, with a lot of anxiety. My parents, they didn't do emotions, and that's not their fault. But that's what I grew up with. So walking into the police, I just did. I functioned. I said a lot about wanting to be practical. I was very good at doing stuff. I am very practical, very practically minded. And I get on and I can work hard. I wasn't prepared for the emotions. In fact, I didn't experience the emotions. I was completely shut off. I was a very dissociative child, what we used to call now a daydreamer. I was rarely present. I was in my head all the time. So this was definitely for me a technique that I used going through my life. I would take myself off somewhere else in my head. And that was my coping. I think what was interesting is when I got married later on in my career, and I met my husband, who's a retired police officer that still works for the police. A bit more institutionalisation there for you. Is that I truly fell in love and I experienced a very strong emotion. And I opened up and I spoke to him and I opened up about emotions and he did with me. And I think it was like Pandora's box for me. And everything came in. All the emotions came in, the good and the bad. And that's what brought me to struggling with my job, where previously I'd not really experienced any emotions. So no, I haven't been prepared. And I think that's quite generational as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your candour there in answering that. I suppose the other side of all the emotional stuff is that what often gets spoken about positively in the emergency services and the prison service is the use of dark humour, banter, camaraderie to cope. What were your participants' reflections on this?
Quite different. And this is indicative of the change of the service over the years, I think. So my participants felt very isolated by dark humour. We used to say that it was a way of coping and you're expressing. A particular example is an officer that was in a very difficult situation where they thought they were going to die. And typically the shift had attended that incident. They'd got back to the locker room and they were joking about the situation and laughing at the situation. And my participant felt that they had to laugh along with it too, where actually they were still really quite scared and processing a lot of what-if emotions. And still dealing with a lot of adrenaline from the situation, and because there was a lot of humour used, they felt that they couldn't talk about it, and this was just another silencing effect.
Yeah,
it's very like men. Were women drawn into this as well?
Yes, and you're right. There are two different perspectives coming into this from the male and female perspective coming into the police culture. The outcomes are pretty much similar, but women say, I walk into this organisation, into this job and put this uniform on people because I'm a woman, expect me to be emotional, and because of that they expect me to be weak, therefore I have to be even less emotional than my male counterparts to prove that I am not weak. Whereas men say, well, as a man I'm not expected to be emotional anyway, in or outside of the job, and that's always been the expectation for me. The organisation just compounds it. So yeah, it's different for both men and women, more so because of the societal emotional expectations that are placed on the sexes.
So SJ, where you were talking earlier, all kinds of memories were coming back to me about people I'd seen whilst working with a police counselling service. And I was thinking about the huge cost to the service of some of those circumstances, and they weren't always the most obvious situations. So what came to mind was a man in his 50s who'd worked as a what's the name of the person who looks after the cells in a police
custody
station?
Custody officer, or jailer, we might call him, detention officer.
A very decent man with a good history of work in the police service, and but he was being persuaded, stroke forced, to go back on the beat because of some newfangled rotation policy. And this has brought up all kinds of issues for him, and he couldn't do it. He couldn't face doing it. So the consequence of that was many, many months of sick leave. And I wonder if sometimes that kind of disturbance goes unnoticed or more unnoticed.
I think, yes, those impacts do. They go unnoticed because they go unheard, or more to the point, they go unsaid, because there is a presumption within the organisation that you will be moved anywhere, and you can be moved overnight for no reason, because it's about resourcing risk, essentially. So I don't think that that individual's welfare based on a move will ever have been a consideration. And when I talked earlier about emotional labour and the implied messages, the message that that sends to officers is that their well-being, their welfare, is less than important in comparison to the job. And what you're describing there is one of those messages. I can't perceive that that individual will find it easy to say to whoever the supervisor was saying that you're going to move, to say, well, actually, I don't think I can do that. Because the response, I don't know, would have been that supportive. I don't know if people know how to deal with that. As I said before, it's quite punitive normally. It's quite shaming. You're not good enough to do the job, then do you belong here? When, as you say, you've described somebody as very competent and very hardworking in a role that I guess they had quite a good skill set at. I think there's a difficulty. And there's a conflict within the organisation that we're still struggling to resolve, in the terms that we do resource risk, and we have a commitment and obligation to the public to prevent harm to others. And because of that, we always put the police officer less. And it's very difficult. But I'd like to describe some other circumstances where these issues go unnoticed. So more often than not, the police service congratulates itself, and I am quite scathing, and I make no real apology for that. The police service congratulates itself for when we have a big incident, terrorist incident, something of that ilk happen, that they can put in some good responsive services to the individuals that dealt with that incident. And that will be a nucleus of people first on the scene, scenes of crime officers, people that dealt with victims. And they will have the TRIM process or some form of counselling, something. And I could talk more about whether I think they're effective or not. What we don't see is the people that are stood on scene for a lengthy time, that are dealing with families because they're stood on scene guard, that people that are viewing body camage footage, reading statements, people that have their own background of trauma, because a lot of police officers have their own background of trauma. Most of us do, had adverse childhood experiences, which mean that can things that may not seem obviously traumatic to one person can be traumatic to another. Attending a suicide, if you've got a family of history of suicide and you're sent to a suicide, you're going to act differently and take that on board differently. And we don't accommodate people's full lives and the way that they experience jobs in different ways. And that's when we overlook people.
And you referred then to some of the measures that have been put in place in an attempt to try and support people's well-being. Could you say a bit more about those?
Well, the first thing is they're always post-trauma, post-ill health, whether it be counselling services. But I'm interested in TRIM and the use of TRIM. It's one of the most often used processes. So TRIM is a process post-incident where people will have a group conversation, and this is just a very brief overview, a group conversation facilitated by somebody that has a psychiatric or psychological background to assist with the processing. So it sounds excellent, because that's the kind of thing that I advocate, people getting together who've experienced the same thing and talking about it in a safe environment. The problem is the organisation is not a safe environment. So you're forcing people to talk in an environment where they don't feel safe, where they don't trust each other, and often with a stranger, somebody who's trained in the TRIM process. Mm-hmm. And it can be quite traumatising because they're afraid of where this is. And as much as you may tell people in the police that it's not going to go anywhere, they don't believe that the organisation's not going to find out what's said. They don't understand or don't know or trust what are the consequences of engaging and being open about their feelings within the TRIM process. And I actually find that it can be quite damaging for people. The other side of the thing is people are often told in the police, and this is also part of the organisation being part of the evidential chain, is that they can't talk about anything until after the case or after the, you know, this part of the investigation's gone ahead. And the same happens with the TRIM process. It's often delayed by weeks, and they're told, don't talk to anybody. So it could be months later that they are off the TRIM process. Within that time, they're told not to talk. And there's just so many problems with the way that very good processes and very good ideas and good counselling, good interventions are badly applied within the organisation, because there's such a lack of understanding of context in the cultural organisation, and how these responses can be seen as shaming and punitive again, even though they're well-meaning.
Thank you. Trauma risk management is the process you're talking about.
Thank you very much. And I do think it's an excellent process when well applied.
Great. So one of the things you've written about, SJ, is the impact on young children of having a parent do a dangerous job. Could you say something about the challenges to family life that having a parent in the police poses to children?
That's, I can only truly speak from my own perspective of being a child. I've done a little bit of research, or more to the point, it's come up within my research, not from the children, from the parent side of things. I can't speak, and I've looked into this, and there's one piece of research on how being a child of a police officer affects that child. It's not published, it's not peer-reviewed. It's a thesis that was conducted a long time back. So I'm not aware of any research that's been done. What did come to light for me was the impact of becoming a parent had on police officers. And that was really apparent. And something that people aren't prepared for when they come back to the organisation is it changes their whole risk assessment when dealing with incidents. It's on their mind when people become new parents and they start dealing with incidents. They're not just thinking, oh, am I going to get hurt? Oh, what's going to happen to me? How am I going to deal with it? They're thinking, I can't go home. I can't not go home. I can't tell my family that I'm in hospital. I can't come back with bruises because my children can't see me that way. And they are the key concerns for people. But also dealing with child death, child protection issues. It's a real struggle for people. And it's not something that is raised within the organisation or that they're cognizant of themselves, that this will be the impact. And it's both men and women. just becoming a parent is we know it's life changing. The organisation probably needs to, you know, be cognizant of it and deal with it and prepare people for that. Being a child of police officers, I don't know. I don't think I was ever scared for my family. I felt a deep responsibility of being the child of a police officer to almost emulate that responsible child. I wasn't very responsible though, I have to be honest. Yeah, there is just a weight on your shoulders as you are known in the playground as the child of. That's for sure.
Yeah, I can believe that. So you've also written about how things change for members of the police when they become parents. You've touched on that slightly, but can you say a bit more about that?
I think the key aspect is threat to themselves and protecting their family. Not wanting to go home injured, wanting to go home, but also not in dealing with child events, child protection issues, becoming very emotionally connected to children in a way that they hadn't previously, wanting to protect children in a more parental way, paternal way, than they perhaps had done before. I think being a police officer and being a parent is very difficult also when it comes to how you deal with your own children and the risks that you perceive around your children. For example, somebody that maybe deals with sex offender management unit can be very suspicious of the people that may be childminders, very concerned who they're leaving their children with, what risks they're placing them at. Children getting involved in drugs, all the normal exploration, envelope pushing behaviours that you see. Police officers see greater risk than most parents. They perceive risk where perhaps they should see an adolescent child. I think that's very difficult for both the child and both the parent in managing that, because it is a different scenario. And as we know, police officers, they're exposed to a lot of threat. They see risk where others may not, and that's their job. But there's a lot of neuroscience research about police officers' amygdala. So their amygdala is firing constantly. We talked about this 24/7 approach to policing. Well, their brain, the neurological systems are working the same way. They're programmed to see risk. Their amygdala is firing. So they're more prone to see risk within the family home, with their children, with other partners, and respond to it in the way that a police officer does, which may not always be the healthiest way of dealing with things. So there's a lot about the makeup of police officers and the way they behave, but the way that the job makes their brain work that then translates into the family home and relationships with children, relationships with spouses, social relationships with friends. All of this takes its toll.
So I can see really from what you're saying how that kind of framework must affect one's close relationships, family, friends relationships. But turning it on its head somewhat, it must affect how people approach their work. If in their mind they're caring for young children, it must make them concerned about the kind of risk that they're facing up to in their job.
Definitely. And there's a distinct change with people. They recognise it in themselves when they're attending jobs, when they're asked to attend jobs, that they're not afraid for themselves. They're afraid what will happen to them, but what the consequences will be for their family. Will I not go home tonight? Isn't about them. It's about their young children, their partner. Am I going to end up in hospital because I don't want to phone up or have to explain to my children why I'm in hospital? Or am I going to get bruised? Am I going to get injured? Because I don't want to have to explain to my young children that the job that mummy or daddy does puts them in danger. And so that's what's at the forefront of their mind. And that's what's going into an event, a situation, is what they're going to be thinking about, which is an added burden on them. And without the organisation having made them aware of that, and allowing them to prepare themselves for that change and to acknowledge that, I think they find it quite difficult.
So I'm guessing there's not a lot of preparation for police officers to face up to those issues.
Definitely not. I'm actually involved in a research project at the moment looking at perinatal mental health in the police service and the intersectionality with police work, as in the organisation, the job itself and the identity. And there's very little that prepares police officers to come back to work after maternity, in sense of, does your job fit? How are you going to manage working as a police officer with childcare? If you have asked to stay on, we work long hours, unpredictable hours. These conversations aren't really had. Flexible working is notorious to achieve within the police service. So if flexible working, in a practical sense, is difficult to accommodate, we go back to that implied sense of the value of the police officer in their family. I don't think they're going to be talking about how emotionally it's going to impact them. And there's certainly nothing in place for that. Those conversations, return to work conversations, don't happen within the police. It's something that we've, an official finding, is return to work interviews that you'd have if you were off sick don't happen on return from maternity. So there's no opportunity presented for somebody to say, so how do you feel about now going out and dealing with these jobs? I was horrified, because I don't have children myself, so I've never experienced this, that people were coming back after having their first child, second or third, but first, most importantly, and supervisors aren't having that conversation or even considering, well, should I be sending you to a job that involves a child? And if I have to, what do I do? What do I need to do to help you with that? Do I need to put somebody else there with you? Do I need to take you away and give you some time afterwards to have a cup of tea and think about it, or just deal with it before you go home? None of this is considered. People return off maternity and go back out and do the job as they did it before.
And yet that seems quite an obvious place to intervene in some ways, doesn't it? It seems like something that would be quite obvious to create some point of intervention, but I suppose I wondered how much these kind of things not happening is a consequence of funding of police, and how thin resources might be.
I think that in a practical sense and operational sense, conversations with sergeants about wellbeing, etc., that's the time that it takes to have that conversation when you've got grade 1 treble 9 calls where, you know, significant risk to life, it's very difficult to justify. And that is a very practical issue that really needs addressing at a public level of expectation of police officers. But there's another thing that's an issue, is the stigmatisation of pregnant women in the organisation. Stigmatised in the same way as mental health, is that you are of no use to the organisation. Well, you can't go out and deal with jobs and you can't be flexible. You are sidelined and shamed and isolated in a similar way that if you'd express a mental health issue. There's a lot of issues. And there's so much work that needs to be done, because there's so much shame in the organisation that if you aren't that ideal person, that robotic police officer that functions without needing to sleep, eat, drink, wee, have a baby, have a family, express emotions, respond to incidents in an emotional way, then you're not of use to the organisation. You're less than of use to the organisation, and then you're a burden. And that's quite clear in the way that people are treated. Needless to say, when we're looking at whether people's mental health is dealt with, perinatal mental health is to dealt with, we've gone right back up the track and we're like, it's not even maternity, it's not even dealt with, not even anywhere near perinatal mental health. We're not even, you know, it's maternity return from work is just an issue.
See, you've touched already a bit on how the demands of policing have changed over time, but do you think there's been a change in police culture and the emotional burden for police over time, or do you think that's something that's stayed pretty static?
I think the two have gone hand in hand. Decades ago, before technology really took off, before communications really took off, we didn't have the same level of calls into the police service, so the burden on police time wasn't as great. Also, internet technology has created new crimes and prolific crimes. which are very difficult to police, and we haven't factored that. We're not coping with that. We're not set up for that yet. So there is an intensity of work that never used to exist, which is a burden on police officers, which is takes away the first thing that we need when we're trying to process, you know, trauma is time. There is less time available to individuals. We've had austerity that has eaten into resources. In terms of, we talked about you losing back office staff. Well, that work doesn't go away. So hello, sergeants, here's your HR work. So that adds to the burden. I also think there's also been a different response to the police from the public. There's a lot more scrutiny on the police on behaviour, a lot less tolerance. There's a lot more transparency within the police. A lot of good things have happened in terms of perhaps corruption or the way the police used to be run. We're a lot more accountable. We're a lot more transparent. This is all good things. But the consequences is for the police officers that feel under greater scrutiny, add into that body cam footage, that they believe that there is greater surveillance on them at all times. Add that mobile phones where people being filmed. I saw the other day in my local high street some police officers who had just stood around patrolling, and they made an arrest and they were filmed by people on their mobile phones, and I never had to deal with that. And that's like a recent thing then. And that pressure is significant, to be filmed all the time. But there's also other changes within the organisation. We talked about dark humour. Well, being politically correct is really important, being respectful of other people. And I think people have struggled to navigate that, how to communicate with each other without insulting each other. But you know what I mean, how to be respectful. I think people have struggled, the organisation has struggled with that as well. But also the social side of policing has been taken away. There used to be a greater sense of the police family, which participants tell me they do not experience anymore. People used to socialise together, families used to socialise together with other police families. They used to have police bars. Now, I'm not advocating a return back to alcohol because that really was a poor coping strategy and I don't want that. But what I'm saying, there used to be spaces, physical spaces for people to get together. We don't have canteens anymore. People don't have places other than their desks, and they won't be their own desks. They'll be hot desking to eat their food. So there isn't a place for people to talk, to get together, to get to know each other, to get to understand what it is as a collective they're experiencing. So there's been a lot of changes within the organisation, within society, that have really impacted on policing. And the expectations of the jobs that police officers do now. Majority of it, there is a mental health angle to it, but police officers aren't trained in mental health, and they may be struggling with their own mental health, and the challenges that come with it are really significant, the changes that we've seen. They really are.
So it sounds like you're saying there's more emotional demands, but actually much less opportunity for even beginning to have some of those conversations in a more informal way.
Absolutely. You can't develop the relationships yet, which would help you with your emotional responses. And yes, there are greater many more emotional demands.
If you were to offer any words of wisdom to someone starting out in the police, what would you advise?
I think it's really important to be self-aware, but that's really hard, as I know. It's recognised that you are going to have an emotional response to the incidents that you see, and that is normal. It's not shameful, it's normal, it's how the human brain works. You need to acknowledge that and acknowledge your emotions. Find somebody you trust, and stick to them like glue, and talk to them and build a relationship. Even if you go to different stations, even if you change police forces, have someone that you can talk to, that you trust, that you know that they understand and will not judge you. And have those conversations. Make them informal, make them regular, but have the conversations. Be mindful that you're a human being, and be an advocate for emotional expression. But beyond all, realise that you deserve to be happy and to have a full life. When I left the police service, it broke my heart. It's not what I wanted to do. But what I have discovered on leaving the police service is that there's a whole world out here that I didn't know or see or couldn't know or see because I was overwhelmed with police work. It's all I saw or I could do or I could experience. I couldn't see the rest of the world. And I really want that for other police officers, to have a full, happy life as well as being a police officer. And they totally deserve that.
You're a very powerful advocate for the police, SJ. You can hear your passion for the profession as well as that kind of like really strongly fighting for people and voicing some of the things that might be really hard to voice if you're actually in the police. So thank you. Really enjoyed today's conversation. There's an awful lot to digest there.
Thank you. Thanks so much for listening. I know I go on.
No, it's been really wonderful talking with you today. I've really enjoyed it and found it quite challenging at times. So many thanks for that.
No, I genuinely appreciate the opportunity to speak about this, not for my research, but it needs talking about. It needs getting out there. If only that if somebody listens and hears this and recognises themselves and what I'm talking about, then maybe it helped them just to cope a little bit better.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was a real pleasure talking with SJ just then. She's got such an experience of the police force and the armed forces before that, and she's coming at it with real kind of sensitivity and understanding of the emotional side of the work, and that enables her to do all this invaluable reflecting upon the processes of the organisation, which I think is can have long-term value.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, David. There were places when SJ was talking when I felt really quite sad and moved by her account. And I think that what you can really hear is her real passion for the people doing these roles and wanting to really advocate for them. And there's a challenging, I think she really truly represents a critical friend to the police, because you can hear that sense of really wanting the best for people in the police whilst also appreciating what a difficult job they do, and so not holding back from making criticisms but doing them in a way that really feels quite respectful and appreciative of the police. And really good to have that opportunity to speak with her.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage lockeduplives.com and our Twitter account Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.